Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is October 1st, and we are Talking in Obscurity, companion podcast to the blog Writing in Obscurity. I'm Kevin Carlson, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
Today we are talking about Red Rising by Pierce Brown.
Red Rising, or as some would say, it's called Green Rising, because some of us, I'm not going to say who, can't see the color red.
Yeah, it's definitely you.
Yeah, it's me. It's you. So Green Rising, loved it.
Very green.
Very green. I mean,
the Irish makes much more sense.
Yeah, my future metaphor you just ruined. It makes a lot more sense now. But no, it's interesting because I actually read this book long before we ever had a podcast because you recommended it to me.
Yeah.
Very, very high. It literally might be one of the first things I bought on Audible.
Yeah.
I'm actually positive it is. And revisiting it for this podcast was actually kind of as fun as a book this brutal can be because it's a brutal book, but it's so well done, and it's not my usual, like, wheelhouse, but it kind of is, because I love, like...
Political theater.
Yeah, right? I love, like, that, it very much has a message, and it hits that message, but not, in, like, in a bad way, where it hits you over the head with it. It hits you over the head with it, because it really has something to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a science fiction story, and I've read all of the Red Rising books, because there's the first trilogy, and then there's a second trilogy, which Pierce Brown hasn't finished yet. Like, they are all intense. Like, highly recommend this series. You're going to be in the right mindset for it, because it's going to be an intense trip.
It's in a weird way, like, you can make the argument, and this book does get compared to it a lot, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones, Hunger Games, where it's a big world with a lot of, like, you stir up some of those tropes of science fiction or like high fantasy, because this kind of is a science fiction fantasy kind of story.
Yeah, it's definitely not a hard science fiction, because like there's fantastic technology that they have no business. He takes no time to describe how it works,
which is fine.
It is what it is.
And I'm always fine with that. I actually feel like often this is one of my biggest problems with. Some like high fantasy books, even some science books, science fiction books, they overexplain to make it seem to me, which I don't need. Just like Star Wars doesn't need to explain to me how the lightsaber works. I just see that it's there, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah. So, well, they're all green to you, like green fighting green.
Yeah, that's true. In this old Star Wars games, you can make your own lightsaber. I always made mine black. I always thought that looked cool.
Yeah.
I don't think it makes any sense in the context
of black light, yeah.
A black lightsaber. It'd be really embarrassing for the teenage younglings with my black light lightsaber. What the hell have you been doing?
Oh.
Stains everywhere. So
let's get into our likes of this book. Well, let's knock it off into the weird. Okay, we're going to get into the likes of
this book. So my main like of this book, honestly, is... It's funny. My main like and my main dislike are going to be right interlinked. My main like is this book does not pull punches. There are certain scenes that are absolutely brutal and they don't pull away and they don't go away. And it's going to literally just be, you have to kind of suffer through it with the sort of the narrator. And you feel the pain that characters are going through when they're going through it. It's really well done.
Yeah. Like the thing that I love the most about book is how intense it is. And I've said this to you several times outside of this, like the main character, Darrow, and this is all from the first person perspective, which if you can do it well, first person is fantastic in putting you in this guy's head. And as a character study, he feels less like a person and more of a force, as a force of nature waiting to be unleashed. We're still in the non-spoiler side of this, but like, he is a reluctant revolutionary, where in this, in like, and I like that model a lot. You see that in the Hunger Games, we made the comparison before, where he did not set out to be this revolutionary figure, but he accepts that this is who he is going to be because of a very significant thing that happens to him very early in the story. I love the passion and the rage that you can feel from this guy in every scene. And there's no scene where he's off.
Yeah, I think that like what makes Garo such a cool character, especially your point of view character, is everything he feels is very valid. I don't think you can read this book and not, unless you're like void of empathy completely, I don't think you could possibly read this book and not feel for what he goes through and not feel for what his sort of suffering leads to. Because he is just, again, we're not in the spoiler part yet, but the beginning of this book, I'll never forget because it's related back to what we, this is the first thing you recommended to me. The first chapter of the book, it feels like it's nice, and then all of a sudden it's not, and you think, oh, what's gonna, and then it keeps going back to, you keep waiting for something to
Like,
interfere
this is not going to go this way, right?
and stop it, but it doesn't. And, I think it inherently that sort of thing, it perfectly encapsulated my second point where this book does a perfect job. And I mean, perfect in the sort of, it's really on the nose of what it's like to live in this very classist, very almost racist society where there are the haves that are worthy of humanity and the have-nots that are not worthy of humanity. And this book does a brutal job of opening up, brutal in the good, best way, where when you're not only seeing how he feels about this pivotal event, but you also see him reacting to people that don't look at him as a person reacting to it.
Yeah.
And it's massive indifference. His suffering and all the bad things that happen to it mean nothing to these people because he's not worthy of it. And it's that is such a just sad thought.
They get into this in the first story a little bit, but what I do like about the other side of this class system, the people at the top, the golds. They're not all universally terrible. They're all benefiting from the way the society is. But you find out that like people are more complex than just good and evil or living off of these slaves. And like there are some people that like are somewhere in between on this art in this conflict really. And it really doesn't come up a whole lot in the first book. I'm like jumping ahead a little bit more in this series is that there are good and terrible people in all walks of life.
The one thing that this just popped in my head. We were hanging out here, not podcast related. We actually do hang out sometimes when we're not recording stuff. And I was talking about the biggest heartbreaking thing about American history. And you always hear this. People make this argument a lot that America is fundamentally like built in white supremacy. And people bring that up a lot. And oh, that everyone back in like the 1700s and 1800s were white supremacists. And I disagree completely. I think the real, and this book does sort of, you sort of hinted at it, that most people aren't mustache twirling evil in this caste system, but they don't care enough to do anything to stop it. And that's sort of the same thing with like American history, that most people that in American history were not inherently evil. Most people aren't evil, but they benefited from the system that was in place. So they weren't going to rock the boat. And I think this book, when you meet sort of the golds that aren't mustache twirlingly evil, but they don't, they're not, they don't, they don't, they feel bad. They understand that, oh, this is a messed up system, but they don't feel bad enough to actually not be a part of it and benefit from it.
Yeah, do things about it.
And I
Like,
think that's the inherent tragedy of.
I think that like the message of these stories is that people can be convinced, but they rarely take their own initiative.
Yeah, and I think that's what this book really does very well. It maybe. Maybe not so much the book itself, but the story it's telling, which what it leads to, hints at that heavily. And I, because I love my biggest problem, not to re I feel bad to talk, but this book's going to inherently be compared to it, The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Every person that you meet that's like not like the good guys are just evil, and like that's boring. Like Hunger Games is great, and I'm not disparaging people that enjoy The Hunger Games, but. A lot of, at least, I'm granted, I've not read The Hunger Games. I think I've only read the first book. So, I mean, I could be completely wrong. Maybe it builds to a better, more complex story. But it always felt like the president, I'm honestly surprised that President was it Snow, at some point is talking to Jennifer Lawrence. I can't remember her name in the book. And just goes,
Katniss.
Katniss, and just, excuse me, Katniss. And he just picks up a kitten and just punts it. He's like, I punted a cat because your name's Katniss. Like,
Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't do that at some point.
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly characters in Red Rising that are also way over the top.
But that's fine as long as you balance it out with.
With there's also people that, well, the majority of people are like somewhere in between on that. And mainly it goes back to the idea of the banality of evil, where it's just people, man. Just normal people that where they came down and where they were born, that's just where they happen to stay.
And that's heartbreaking.
It's hard to change one's views, especially whenever you know that it's going to be uncomfortable and potentially life-threatening.
And why would you change a system that you're benefiting from?
Yeah. To go to a recurring thing that I would bring up, I listen to this on Audible. You listen to this
Yeah.
on Audible. I love this narrator because,
Yeah.
like, I love his specific Irish accent that he puts to all of this, because I think it really adds something to the story. Although I suggested this book to another friend of ours, and he could not listen to it because he just could not stand this guy's
He hates
accent.
the Irish. He just really doesn't like the Irish very much.
I don't know, man. Like, I thought that Tim Gerard Reynolds' Irish brogue perfectly
Well,
encapsulated this story.
I think it works for kind of the meta the story the metaphor of what the story is about,
Yeah.
and sort of to relate it back to another thing I liked about it. Another thing I love about this story is there's a bit that's building. It builds to it, and you think the twist is coming. There's a big twist that's going to be revealed, and it's going to be you know where it's going. And they completely turn the twist on its head, and it doesn't go re the obvious
Yeah.
conclusion. And in a weird way, because of that makes the twist actually a good twist. Because you think, it is, to me, a good twist doesn't have to be bad in nature. Sometimes it can be the,
It can be sort of positive. Well, it is positive.
yeah, and I think this book really nails it. And I really like the sort of fake out.
So, shall we move to our not what we didn't love about this book?
Yeah, sounds good. That's, yeah, good idea.
So I'll go first on our dislikes. We were talking about The Hunger Games, and like The Hunger Games, this book one is very much concerned about the pre-revolutionary matters, and it's building to, like, clearly Darrow is going to be the leader of some sort of revolution, and it's very much building in that direction. And if you think at the end of this story it's really going to scratch an itch, it does not. It's still about, like, still in that pre-revolutionary mode.
Yeah, that's kind of my to sort of build upon what you're saying. That was one of my primary complaints about this book. It just feels like a book one. It doesn't really feel it doesn't feel like a very self-contained story that ends and you can feel really good. Oh, okay, that was a great story. Now I want to see what happens next. It feels very much like it's setting up a sequel. And most of the that's actually the biggest flaw throughout the entire book is that it feels like someone telling the story. Don't you worry though, it's going to get real exciting, and it is exciting. But the other, I always think back to the Simpsons joke when Marge starts selling pretzels, and she puts out the falafel business out, she puts out a business with a mob. So there's a big mob war on the Simpsons front yard with the mob and the Yakuza. And Homer's watching it like it's TV. And Marge's like, leave him alone, let's get out of here. He's like, Marge, that little guy hasn't done anything yet. You know when he does, it's gonna be amazing. And that's this book. The little guy hasn't done anything yet, but you know when he does, it's going to be incredible.
And why does this these stories go places? The another thing that I found that I didn't so much enjoy is it really comes to a standstill in the it's a very fast-paced story, but, like, it comes to this slow down and standstill whenever it's over describes the torture scenes and the, like, how much he's afraid of something, or, and at a certain point you get it, like, it's bad. This is bad. Let's move on to the next thing. Like, this was one of those stories that really crystallized for me that I do not enjoy torture scenes because they always end in one of two ways. And either the person dies or they get their revenge. And I always find myself, whenever they're talking about scenes where like when he's being taken apart and put back together, it goes on for a long fucking time.
Yeah, maybe this is, I don't care. This won't be politically correct, but I don't like torture. I know that's gonna be a that's gonna offend some of you snowflakes out there that I don't like torture, but I just don't like I don't.
I don't care for
The
it.
more I hear about this torture thing, the more I don't care for it.
Yeah.
But I kind of in the same. I feel bad. I feel like we're just in a lot of agreement on this book, but I agree. I think the brutality at times, while being an effective tool, is a tool that's overused. And it's a tool that eventually gets, it almost makes you numb to it. I feel like the more torture you have in like a hardcore torture where it's like not like Saw level torture, but where you describe pretty brutal things, eventually you just get desensitized to it. It's very similar to what made the Theon being tortured in Game of Thrones so effective is he didn't see people getting tortured that often in Game of
Yeah.
Thrones. Having him, this character, go through all these like hardcore, horrible things has a lot of weight to it. And the first like bit where this character's going through like it's a little bit of a spoiler bit, but his surgery, you're like, oh, it's awful, wow. And then there's other scenes that are really brilliant. Oh, okay, we get it. And like the
Yeah.
scene where I can't remember he murders somebody, and it's a pretty brutal murder.
Oh, yeah.
And like it's in very specific details how it's done. And you're like, okay, we get it. Can we just he's dead. Can we
Can we move
move
on?
on
Can we
now?
move on now?
And that's what I feel like is one of my probably my chief complaint of this book is that, because it's so brutal, it feels like it has to be brutal. It has to constantly one up its own brutality.
Yeah, I like that's the thing with any sort of grim dark story, which this is, I would say it's fair to say that this is grim dark for the kids out there. It's dark from the beginning and it never is not dark. Like it gets I've described this series and this book like I dread the next chapter, but yet I have to know what the next chapter will bring. Because, and that's the feeling that I always had with this is like, I would finish a chapter and I'm like, wow, that was intense. But I need to start the next one.
Yeah, that it's funny because I, generally speaking, have a pretty high threshold for messed up. We always joke that my wheelhouse in cinema is messed up foreign movies, where I feel like if I'm shown a movie, it's probably going to be make you feel a little sad, or just ugh, what is this? But even I at times was like kind of that same vein where I'd be listening to a chapter and I'd be walking, I'd be very invested in it, but I'd be like, oh, this is kind of like hurts. Why don't I? But then I keep doing it. It's honestly like eating the best spicy curry from an Indian restaurant, where you it hurts every time you take a bite,
Yeah.
but it tastes so good that you can't stop.
That is a perfect way to describe this book. I know we're in the not like part, but like that is a really good metaphor. It's like really great spicy food. It hurts
Yeah.
every time, but yet you keep going.
Because
And
it
like,
tastes good too.
yeah, that encapsulates what this experience is
Yeah,
like.
and I like. It's interesting. I feel like the other thing that this book sort of sticks with me as I sort of we move on to the next bit is that as the characters are going through all these things and as the characters are sort of growing and changing as the stuff around them is happening, at times it feels very small because despite this book taking place in space. And characters are doing things in this big, vast world. It's a very personal story. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you're not getting a ton of world building to it. And world building is something that I don't think is 100% necessary. It doesn't really like take away from the book's effectiveness of it. But I do wonder, okay, so how did we get to this point? And like, what's the like reason for it? And for the most part, it's fine that you're just like, this just is. And that's okay, but for a book and a series that has it goes to bigger places, for this first story to not have any kind of or very limited amount of world building feels like a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Shall we move into the spoiler side of this
Let's
and start talking about our analysis
yeah,
and get into the nitty-gritty specifics?
absolutely. And like I said, I think you went first. I'll go first this time. This book is the It's funny you bring up the narrator being Irish, and I feel like that is very, very deliberate. Because this book, to me, is 100% a deep space metaphor for the Irish and British conflicts. And it does a perfect job of the inherent flaws of a caste system and how that if you have people that are less than, inevitably, after multiple generations of them being less than, they'll stop being people. And the super haves will not think of them as anything other than just sort of a one step above animals. And in a lot of ways, to compare it to what's going on today, as you saw when the Queen passed away relatively recently, that people in England were very upset.
Oh, where were they?
And but every once in a while, you would see there's a great joke of Irish Twitter had a field day with not caring about the Queen passing away, because you know, the Queen is this representative of this old world of England. You know, that she had no power inherently. It's ceremonial, but it's a reminder of what the British Empire used to be: royalty, monarchy. But for the Irish, monarchy, the British monarchy is a pretty terrible thing. And like the people always make fun of the Irish or the potato famine, which I don't think that's kind of morbid. Hey, your people almost got wiped out because of famine, but the potato famine happened specifically because the English let it happen. And I think this book is kind of a great metaphor of the inherent problem with any kind of overly, I don't want to say capitalistic, but it is capitalistic society where eventually the end game of that extreme capitalism unfortunately becomes fascism.
The first thing I want to talk and getting into like specific details, getting specifics of why this is such a fucking dark story, is right from the jump in the prologue, before the wholesome bit that you were talking about and your likes. I don't know if you quite remembered him telling the charming story about whenever the Golds hung his father,
Oh yeah, I forgot about
and
that.
like, and you find out like, because this takes place on Mars, and so gravity is less on Mars because it's a smaller planet. And the detail that really sticks with me is like right from, see, page one, page two, somewhere in that range, where he talks about when they hang you on Mars, the gravity isn't enough for your neck to break. So they let the loved ones pull their feet.
I forgot about that. Oh, I forgot about, yeah, it's literally the opening part of the book. Oh.
And he was talking about how they hung his father because he danced a forbidden dance. And when they hung him, and he was so numb watching his father strangling to death, doing the hanging dance that people do as they're strangling to death, he remembers that it was unfortunate that his last dance, he wasn't wearing his dancing shoes.
That's such a, yeah, I think that like the thing about this book, that should tell you right away it doesn't get better because you know you think, wow, what could be worse than your father you being there and having to sort of pull your father's legs while he's being hung to death? Well, they I see your hanged father and I raise you a hanged wife because the love of his life gets hanged for
Singing in
essentially
a forbidden
singing a forbidden
song.
song, and then you know because why not? It perfectly, you know, comes full circle. You can't sing, you can't dance. Honestly, this book is if the space race was won by the people that ran that Footloose town.
I was wondering when you'd make that joke.
And it's like, well, no one can dance or sing on our new planet, so.
It's oddly musical, and it's like at times, because there's an entire section where I hate this with like Lord of the Rings, whenever they bust out a song, and instead of just saying that was a very merry song, it was a melancholy song, Tolkien would write out the songs. And there's a scene late in the book where Darrow and a new girl,
Mustang.
Mustang, are sort of exiled together, and she's like sort of dying at the time, and he sings that forbidden song again because he not learned his learned the lesson of what happened to his wife. And it's a really great scene because he writes out the whole word, all the words too. It's a fucking good song.
And I'm also going to say that Irish sad songs sound better with Irish accents. I'm going to say it. I, you know, I like something about that accent of the narrator gives so much weight to when you hear the songs, on, like on when you listen on Audible. And there's something very, it's like beautiful, but it's hauntingly beautiful. And like it's But it's it because of what you know literally what happened in like the first like 4 minutes of the book, if you listen to it on Audible, you sort of feel a tinge of uncomfort, that you're uncomfortable. Because you sort of know, oh, I mean, this song is bad. This is sad.
This is the song that his wife sang and got herself killed.
And like there's something just brutal about it. And I will say the thing that and like that I and that we can openly talk about is the other brutal scene I could do without is the slow. It feels like it took about 47 hours of them describing him being surgically changed
Yeah.
to be a gold.
Because, like, the honest of the story, very quickly, because we don't do synopsises anymore, is that there's a caste system on Mars. People are ranked by their color, gold being the top, red being the bottom. Darrow was a red. And after his wife was hung for singing that forbidden song, the sort of underground, well, he got himself into trouble right after that and also got hung. He got saved by the underground, and they surgically revamped him so that he could be a deep cover agent as a gold. And yeah, that's the scene that you're.
Yeah, it's just the thing is, I get that it's why you would describe it. It gives it weight because like no one felt that bad for the $6 million man, Steve Austin,
Yeah.
because we just he was well, we built him, and then all of a sudden he's rebuilt.
You didn't need like 5 to 10 minutes of hearing his absolute
Yeah,
agony.
like but so as a result, it's fun, it's lighthearted, but so him being changed in every way imaginable. Because how could you not be emotionally and mentally changed from seeing your wife die? And so not even that, you have to then inherently have the physical change. And it's earned because it's brutal the way they describe
Yeah, they break
his
every bone in his body.
everybody. It's what are there? I mean, what do you have, like 10 bones? And they're all broken.
Yeah,
And there's
I think there's actually a little few more, like 15 or 20.
something like that. Yeah. And so hearing that or reading it, whatever, it doesn't matter. Reading it, hearing it hurts because, I have bones. And so
If your 20 bones
imagine if
broke.
all my bones broke. That would really be a bad day.
Yeah, like if they make them regrow longer, denser. Do all that shit with your muscles and
Like
nerves and
imagine if you woke, you went to bed 5'6" and woke up 6'5". Like that would be a
the fact that they had to rip his eyes out. Yeah,
it's just,
cool.
yeah. And I literally cringe thinking about like it's just such a thing
You
that
forgot about the eye part,
I
didn't
did.
you? Like, the fact that he had red eyes, like the reds, and now he has gold eyes.
The golds. There also the other thing that's like perfect about this story is that, inherently when people think caste systems, they always think of India because most of our modern caste system was in India during the British colonization of it, occupation of it. And this is like if someone said, what if the British were less nice? And like this is like the golds are not mustache twirling, all of them. But like the governor, for example, is the most villainous piece of shit. Like you just hate him
Yeah.
instantly. And he is and you think, oh, maybe there'll be like a little bit of like a humanizing moment. Nope.
Nope, he's just awful from start to finish in the story.
He's awful and he has children that you meet. Like you think, oh, maybe he loves his kids. Nope. He doesn't really love his kids. Like there's a reason, spoiler, the twist I was referring to earlier is Mustang is actually the governor's daughter. And I was convinced that once you kind of figure that out, that oh, of course she's gonna betray.
Yeah, she's gonna betray Darrow.
But she betrays her father.
Yeah.
And she truly believes in the cause that Darrow's fighting for. And I actually love that. I think that's more of a testament, not that she is an agent of change because she believes in the right thing. I think it's also because her father was a piece of shit. Like to be honest with you, like if my father was like the architect of a terrible system and he was so awful to me, I'd be pretty willing to betray him too. Like,
I don't think he invented the system, but he definitely
no.
inherited, became the governor of Mars, and like he's invested firmly in
Yeah,
the
he's not
real
the because this is 700 years
world.
after they
Like
colonized.
that's another huge like because they kept telling the Reds that they were like the first colonists of Mars. That's why they live underground and have to get continuously mine. But like I love the big sense of betrayal Darrow has whenever he finally gets to go to the surface of Mars and finds out that they terraformed it like centuries ago.
Yeah.
And the whole the story that they were telling for generations was like, yep, any day now the ships are gonna come from Earth and we're gonna terraform Mars and you're gonna get your reward and get to live on the surface like everybody. And that happened centuries ago, and they just kept them on as slaves because slaves are good for the economy.
Yeah, and that, I think that's the other thing about this is this book, not to get too political, but we do on this podcast every now and then, that's fine. It really shows the extremes of, unfortunately, where when you only care about the economic value of a quote unquote lesser than, the lengths you'll go to keep that system in place for yourself, because that's what this book inherently is about. Is about the flaws of extreme unfettered capitalism, because capitalism is it's great. It has its place, and it's not inherently itself evil. But if you let it go unchecked, I'm sorry, eventually it goes evil.
Yeah, I think that's like with any authoritarian government, is that inevitably it gets more and more to the point where like people are not normally this evil, but like the whole system seems bent to pushing you that way. I think the like to switch gears here, that this first story is very much, it feels a lot like The Hunger Games, because primarily what this story is about is, like I said in the non-spoiler side, it deals with pre-revolutionary matters, because this is Darrow is injecting himself into Gold Society. There's this resistance called the Sons of Ares that like had him surgically altered to look like a gold, trained him to talk and act, and gave him a basic education so he could like sneak
Be
in
a
and
gold.
be a gold. And what the story is mainly focused on, this first one at least, is his education as a gold, because there's a final school for golds before they get to become adults. And that school is basically just the fucking Hunger Games. Like people are divided into houses, and the whole point of this game is to see which house wins.
Gotta fight to the death.
And it's fitting that Darrow gets put in House Mars, which is traditionally the color red, and he's a red. Kind of, I don't know if you would call that irony or
Dramatic irony.
dramatic irony, like, but it's interesting that he's pretending, and I think it actually is irony because he's a red pretending to be a gold in the house that's red.
Yeah, I guess that would be irony.
Yeah. So the rules of this game and is that there are no firm rules. It's just which house will defeat the other ones in this very primitive setting that they're put in. And it's shocking to find out that like the golds anticipate that, 30 to 40% of their children that go through this are going to die, and they just accept that. Like on day one, to get in, you have to kill another kid, and Darrow has to kill one of his early friends' brother, and I think you talked about that early on,
Yeah.
and it's not a quick, nice death.
No, it's slow, and I'll say this, even though I think it's kind of a negative, it does give some weight to the murder, because I always think of most murders in movies are quick. Like, if you watch any like scary movie where a guy's like, meanwhile, if you actually kill someone with like a knife, or I think he
He strangles
strangles
them
him to
to
death,
death.
it's brutal. It takes forever.
Yeah.
And as it should, because humans, turns out, we're really hard to kill.
Yeah, and the thing that like I think makes it especially upsetting is because Julian was like one of the first golds that Darrow meets as a, now that he's quote unquote a gold. And Julian's a nice kid.
Yeah.
He isn't like a mustache twirling or a, because he comes from a rich family too, the governor's family, but like the
They're
second
very well to do.
the Bellonas are like the second family of Mars. He seemed like he was nice to Darrow, and he was like kind of his first friend, and he was also the first person he murders.
Which, I mean, we've all been there.
Well, other than his own wife,
Yeah.
because he did have, well, his father. Darrow's killed a lot of people.
Darrow's got some red in his ledger. For gonna, I think one thing about this like story But it's so on the nose that you almost have to respect it, is it really shows you that if you're a person trying to infiltrate a whatever entity, you have to inevitably become part of that entity.
Yeah.
And there's no way around it. Like, you can't possibly go undercover and try to trick people without becoming that.
Being just as brutal and
And
like
you have to be. If anything, you're more brutal because you know the inherent wrongness of what you're doing.
on the to build the bounce off of that, there's a subplot that I had forgotten about until we started talking about this before we started recording. Where Darrow finds out that in the school, an early rival of his, a young man called Titus, you find out that he is also a Red, and he was also a deep cover agent that he didn't know them. They didn't know each other, but like two different cells within the resistance apparently had the same hit on the same plan, and they ran into each other and they were rivals. And Titus was just brutal. He didn't have. Darrow is brutal, but he's brutal with a purpose. Like he has an end goal that he's channeling this to. Titus is just brutal. And in the end, whenever it comes to blows, Darrow has to kill Titus despite the fact that
They're on the same side.
they're on the same side of this conflict because he could not contain his rage, could not channel it in any way. Titus was just there to kill as many goals as he possibly could.
And I think in that, talk about the, it's a perfect sort of example of Darrow is not only, he's emotionally changed and he has that anger and he's physically changed, but because of that, he knows how to like put that anger to use. As opposed to Titus, who's angry and hate-filled, and that's all he is. He
Yeah, because he just becomes a rapist and a murderer.
can't help himself. And there's a it, it's a if you're going to have a temper and you're going to be like brutal, you better learn how to use it properly. Otherwise, you end up just as bad, if not worse, than the people you are
You
trying to
set up
stop.
to destroy.
And you become the very thing you swore to destroy. Like,
And I think that like it doesn't come up in this story, but like as we go further into the series, it's the shifting viewpoints that because Darrow starts as an absolute, sort of like how Titus becomes an absolute. And like they hate the Golds and they will do anything to destroy them and cause them pain for the savagery that they of this caste system. But Darrow, even with that moment with Titus never compromises. He's just there to hurt people. And Darrow, on the first step of the, on his journey of ch have his shifting views, never that he never changes his mind that this society needs to be defeated. He absolutely always sticks to that, but he changes his viewpoints on like how to accomplish that, becomes more realistic as time goes on. Whereas Titus can't adapt. Now, like I think that it's a good first step.
well, I think that, like, it's like anything. It's you're gonna compare it to X-Men, Charles Xavier versus Magneto. They're both inherently on the same side of the issue. Mutants deserve more than they get, but it's how you go about it. For Xavier, it's equality. It's we just want to be thought of as the same. Magneto is no, we're better. Therefore, we should be the ones brutally in charge. And I think this kind of the same vein of Titus and Darrow, where it's Darrow sort of learns to have the sort of point of, well, you have to be pragmatic. You have to learn to bend on situations. Otherwise, you're not going to accomplish your goals. And Titus is like, no, screw that. The only good gold is a dead gold and a raped gold for me.
Which that like reminds me of this point where just because somebody is the oppressed party in a situation doesn't necessarily automatically make them a good person.
Yeah, there are plenty of shitty people that are part of horribly oppressed groups,
Yeah.
and that's just life.
And I think that's the example. Like you can explain away certain things about Titus that like, well, he's that like that because of what they did to him. Like, but he's also like that because he has the capacity to be like that, and he chose to be that way.
Yeah.
At a certain point, he is a bad person because he chose to be a bad person.
And
He did not rise above his situation.
I think that like sometimes it's important to really remember that just because you're on the right side of a conflict does not mean that you're always right in all things. And we often, especially when history is written, tend to romanticize the people on the right side of a conflict. And but for the most part, any conflict, whether if it's big enough, there's going to be people on that are just terrible and they're wretched and they're just as bad, if not worse, than the people they're fighting against.
Yeah, and I think that the early this first story does at least that isn't is interesting is it shows Darrow's capacity, because it really is a story. The point of the story is a character story of the creation of the reluctant revolutionary leader, is his ability to work with the tools that he has. Because everybody in the school, at first he thinks it's just going to be him as that was a red. Nobody knows that because he's masquerading as a gold. And he didn't know that Titus was also a red until their final conflict, really. But it shows that Darrow can work with other golds. Like, he makes friends with Roque and Mustang and Severo and Cassius before he, stabs him through the chest because he finds out that he killed his little brother, and he really just can't get over that.
It turns out.
Yeah, it turns out that's, dead brother. Not really
Well,
sour friendship.
yeah, I mean, we've all listened. Who among us hasn't had a friend that killed a sibling and then we get really mad about it?
All right, so shall we shift into our
Parting
parting
thoughts.
thoughts? I think that I was talking about this with you at some point, that this is one of those stories like V for Vendetta that seems less ridiculous in today's political climate versus when I first read it. Like, the idea that the fascists could win one day, and then it's just generations of fucking awfulness.
This story, in a lot of ways, in today's climate, not even just in the United States, but globally, I think back to, the fascist one in Italy just recently,
Yeah.
in an election,
Far,
and
they call them far right now.
the far, and so the idea that like you could have a whole system based on generation after generation of not just people being oppressed, but people being sort of told that this is what the system is because it's always been this way. And that's so hard to undo.
Yeah, the fact that they actually use genetics and genetic therapies to create eugenic differences between these people. Like, Darrow doesn't have a training scene where he works out and he can look like a gold. He has to be surgically reconfigured to be a gold. Like, that's like Hitler's wet dream, is that there would be literal people that are physically different, like superior in strength and speed and all of this, not because they deserved it. But because they were born to a certain
They were
person.
bred that way.
Like, that is, I think, the most terrifying thing about the story, is that, like, it takes his idea and takes it to its logical maximum, where, like, they actually have the technology to make people into, you don't see too many of them other than in the early chapters, but the Obsidians, they're not golds, but they're higher up than reds. They're, like, several castes down from golds. But they're like super soldiers. They're like described as 9 feet tall, and they have like 12 fingers. And like, you would not look at them and think, "Oh, that's a normal guy," because that's how far and bizarre this universe has become. Is that the castes aren't just arbitrary? Like, the reds just happen to all dress in red and have red hair. No, they're all bred to have red hair, and all the golds are all bred to have gold hair. And if you don't have it, they just genetically fix this.
There's something so inherently ugly about the idea of a system where it isn't just, well, we're better because of blank. The actual thing is we are better because we are bred that way, and we will breed you to be worse. It doesn't matter that you could easily not have to do this.
Yeah.
It's your choosing to do it. It isn't so much that it isn't like.
And even if they genetic random, like through normal evolution, were to make you give you a superior trait, we will just use genetic engineering to edit that out of you.
And like there's something just disgusting about that in every way. And this story in general just makes me realize that it just makes me think that in a system where there are haves and have-nots, there's just no way to make that not evil. It can't be. And I think about comparing it to sort of today's world where the United States is not, a fascist government by any means, and I know that there's a lot of, you're seeing a lot of people talk about fascism and sort of creeping fascism. But the problem is when you give a small group of people just universal power, like for example, say like there were like six or seven people that had like a lot of money, and we just let them do whatever they wanted, and like laws didn't apply to them anymore.
You go to space because I just said
They
so.
could just go to space because they wanted to. Like imagine if that existed. Like if, I mean, I know it's far-fetched.
No, but
That inherently is a problem because eventually it becomes just they're the our betters because they have more, and we are the worst because we have less. And this book is to the extreme degree where you are not only are we their better because we are physically better, but they are absolutely objectively worse than us, and they deserve to be down there. Why would they not be? Because look, they're barely human. Why does it matter?
That's the terror of this book, is that like they make this the world like this. And I think that I think that the most the thing that I well, why I keep reading this these very dark stories is that Darrow shows the just by existing shows the capacity of the human will, just because he's given every disadvantage and yet he still continues on that. This system does not take into account the idea that somebody could resist and keep resisting and start winning.
Like to quote Man of Steel, what if a child dreamed of being more than society intended them to be? And Darrow is that. Now he's not Superman, he doesn't have like, he's but he is very much the idea of the principle of what if you just wanted to be better? And what if you did anything you could to inherently be better? And not better in the sense that you're not making people worse, but better in the sense that you are trying to improve your own situation in life. And he does that, and it takes it to the most brutal conclusion of it, a brutal surgery, having to go get over the heartbreak of losing the love of your life. And all these things that happen, we talked about earlier, the inherent selfishness that his wife sort of demonstrates by letting herself be killed, not realizing that what this is going to have to do to her husband. Because not only is he emotionally damaged, he's physically broken and rebuilt, and he's forever different. There's no way he can go back to being what he was. He can't. It's impossible. That version of him is dead.
I mean, they're very, he has very much two different lives, like, and I love the sad disconnect that he has with it, with Io, where she gives him this whole little speech about like how she dreams of a world where her children will be born free and they will own the land that their father fought for them and gave them, and that they will be what they want to be, and that's beautiful in its own sense, but like you can, it's tragic because the very next thing he says is like, my dream was always just to be with you.
Yeah. It's one of the sort of, before we wrap up here, the one thing about this story that really like made me sad is, so I'm married, and I love my wife. She's like the most important person in the world to me. And what's heartbreaking about it is, what if like society was so, built in such a way that the only thing you could really depend on was the person you love, and that person's taken away from you. And now not only is the person you love gone, you have to then try to basically change the whole world
Because that was her dream.
because that was her dream. So you're not you you it almost robs you of your own agency.
Yeah, and I like as these stories go on, that he meditates on that point is that like his entire life has become fighting for her dream. And I love the idea that he is a reluctant revolutionary, but he, whenever he decides to do it, he's all in. He never questions whether or not he should or should not be doing this. Like he's just, maybe like he has a few moments of doubt here and there, but like, who would, but it's, he, you can get the feeling that he's almost always on, like, this is what he's doing, despite the fact that he comes to the conclusion, like, that she's really done this to him, where he would have been content to live his entire life as just a miner, as a red, and lived out the rest of his days with Io.
And yeah, I think that's sad, man. That's actually the biggest heartbreak of the story to me, is that this hero who is your hero and you root for him, you want him to win, you want him to, accomplish this woman's dream, his wife's dream, but it wasn't his dream. And that's just sad. Like, imagine if you learn that, like, Malcolm X only did what Malcolm X did because his wife really wanted him to do it. Like it would still be a pivotal person in the history of the United States. But it would just be sad that he did it because of the worst heartbreak you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave you on that down note. What's our next book? It's
So
your pick.
I figure since I know it's October 1st today, and we're going to do two, lucky for everyone, we're doing two podcasts this month, not because we couldn't get to it in September, not because I'm just a bad person, but no, we decided to. But the one I want to do is because it'll be Halloween. I want to do The Hellbound Hearts by Clive Barker, the story that inspired the Hellraiser movie, one of my favorite horror movies of all time. And the novella, I've actually only I've only read it like probably a decade ago. I've not read it since, so I'm really excited to get back to it and sort of revisit it. And I think it'll be a really good sort of story for Halloween.
Well, I look forward to it. I know I talk about horror a lot, but I've never actually watched any of the Hellraiser movies, nor have I read this. So it's a good introduction for me.
So yeah, I guess that's a good logical close point. We'll see you next time, y'all, and hope you enjoyed this.